Simon Wilson, senior writer at the New Zealand Herald. Thank you for joining me. I don't know. As a reporter, as a senior writer, as a columnist, a journalist, whichever is the correct title, maybe it's all of the above.
Yeah.
Do you wear your political allegiances on your sleeve, do you think? Because I have an impression of you, but it might just be that you're playing each ball on its merits, and I'm not sure whether I know or not, you know?
I regard myself as being on the left.
Yeah.
And I, these days, column writing, opinion writing tends to be a good chunk of what I do. I also write features and do some news reporting as well. If I'm doing news reporting, it's just straight down the line reporting what happened.
Yep.
If I'm writing features, there'll be some analysis in it. And I'll bring the way I analyze things, I guess, my political perspectives into that. But I try to make it clear and I try to be balanced and I try to make sure that the different points of view are given a fair hearing. The columns I write are from the perspective of this is what I would call a progressive way to look at this.
Yeah, sure. Okay, and that was the impression I got of you. But I know, and I've said this to you before about what we do in our other podcast where we've talked, that we don't carry water for anybody. So even though that was my impression, I was wondering, are you just playing each ball on its merit? So when you talk about the sort of racist rhetoric of David Seymour, which we've talked about before, and that can still be called out by someone who has a perspective of a more conservative value. So it was, I'm interested to know, how does it go, I was just going to say
in relation to that, that in my view, a lot of issues that the left adopts or are regarded as left-wing issues, I don't know why they are. I don't know why racism has to be seen as a left-wing issue, as I think you just suggested. I don't know why climate change has to be regarded as a left-wing issue. You know, I mean, that's just an astonishing thing to me that it is. And I think that's a great failure of the right in this country to think that because they're anti-left, and I think that's what motivates a lot of people on the right, particularly in Parliament on the right, because they're anti-left, they can't be supportive of causes that the left picks up. I don't know why poverty has always been regarded as a left-wing issue either. And a lot of people on the right would say it isn't, of course.
Jesus. I mean, I've got things to talk about, and you've just said two things which could be an hour-long podcast. No, we're going to go. Because I was wondering about you and your progressive ideologies, if I can put it that way, sitting in NZME as well, and you're talking about the anti-left kind of arguments coming from the right, and we've just had the situation on News Talk ZB with Cyclone Gabrielle and, of course, the rigmarole around Hosking and all those kinds of guys as well. And you may not be able to comment on this depending on, because it's your company, but it feels very much like, in fact, I put a tweet out and someone responded to my tweet. You know, when someone responds to your tweets and they do it better than what you have done? And they basically said, information coming from the government, I don't like the government, therefore bad information. And that seems to be a theme that came through from the right for some of this thing. But also what came through News Talk ZB around Gabrielle. I mean, whether you want to speak specifically to that or more speak generally to it, I'd love to get your thought on that, though, because that's sort of what I hear you saying about the anti-left rhetoric.
Yeah, I guess the first thing I'd say about that is that I work at the Herald by choice, and I'm pleased that I do. I like working in a pluralist mainstream media organisation. I like that my work is published alongside that of people of different perspectives, so that we are we're a place where you can go to find different ways of looking at the world, and you can weigh their merits. I value that. One of the reasons I value that is that it means I'm not talking just to people who think like me. I do like talking to people who think like me. I like discussing the issues and analysing with them, of course. But I also really like it when people say to me, "Oh, you know, I read you all the time, and I like reading you. I don't always agree with you," which usually means they don't often agree with me, but they like reading me. A lot of people say that actually, and I really value that. I think that's a great thing that there are those channels open. Am I comfortable with everything that my colleagues, some of my colleagues at News Talk ZB say and do? Of course not. Yeah, I don't have to like everything they say to like the principle of pluralism, but it's absolutely not.
What I hear you saying, and we talk about it in our nightly show, is rage clicking. We'll take a rage click or a supportive click when we're talking about it on the internet. That's still a click, and they're still with us, and we're finding more and more on our evening show that we're getting some of the same people come back. I talk about the Howard Stern example. Howard Stern in his movie talked about being a young drive show host and rating more highly than the old school breakfast host. And the manager was like, what the crap's going on here? What's the story? And so they researched Howard Stern's audience as a young broadcaster, and they found out that half of the people that listened said, we love him and we want to know what he's going to say next. And the other half people said, we hate him and we want to know what he's going to say next. Yeah. So both ways through his audience. And he wasn't doing it to, he wasn't playing games. That's just how his perspective was. And much like yourself, I quite enjoy when people say, you know, I don't agree with what you're saying a lot of the time, but I find you fair, or I don't agree with what you're saying a lot of the time, but you're consistent, or, you know, and you get these people from different perspectives coming in. So yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Yep. I'm just going to say on that, there's an imbalance in the whole thing as well. If you're the shock jock, if you're tabloidy, if you're the guy who the presenter or whatever who wants to outrage, you've got outrage at your disposal to use, and of course it gets a lot of clicks, and it builds up an emotional audience response. I like to think that I'm not doing that. I like to think that I'm putting a well-presented argument together and representing some values of thinking things through and analyzing clearly and all the rest. People might disagree with that, but that's what I like to think I'm doing. So I'm not after rage. I'm not trying to stir up outrage in that way. I think I probably want to say that if it's easy to stir up outrage, it's also, there's an awful lot of people in the world who don't want it, don't like it, and are looking for commentary and analysis that isn't based on it.
Completely agree. And it's that idea of, you know, we get quite a bit, oh, you're such a lefty. And then I typically go, okay, now tell me about the actual argument. Now, that's fine. Yeah, it's like saying, oh, you're an Australian, or oh, you're tall. It's about as valid as a criticism, you know. So I was like, that's cool. Yes, you're right. And I open about that. Now take the argument that I've made and tell me where that's wrong. Just let's look at the scoreboard as opposed to the who's putting the digits on the scoreboard, so to speak. Well, Christopher Luxon this week, because you brought up climate change, coming out being so strong in making it so clear finally about man-made climate change. It did feel a little bit like a hostage video when he was talking to, like the number of times he had to say it after the night before we and others were saying, yes, he's saying yes to climate change, but what does that mean about man-made? But he came out, look, I don't want to be one of those people that go, yeah, but does he really believe it? Because he said it. The really important thing about him saying it for me from the left is twofold. The first is that it's the right thing to say in the right perspective. That's the most important. But secondly, he's going to have people who are voters for him hate that he said that, because they're not going to want him to say, to buy into, quote unquote, the sort of left-wing ideology, as you identified earlier on, of man-made climate change, which actually may help the left come election time, because, you know, bloody Luxon's gone woke. Can't vote for him. Can't vote for bloody Luxon anymore. He's gone woke. You know, next he'll be saying the Maori need a Maori health authority. Good God. But I'm interested in your perspective on what Luxon has done this year, just around climate change, his coming out of the closet a little bit, and also what that means for the election, if anything.
Well, I think the people who are, if people are perceiving Luxon as having gone woke, you know, they're likely to go and vote ACT. And ACT has been extraordinarily skillful for many years now. David Seymour's an expert at this, at recognising what is an issue that no right-minded person would think, gun control is the obvious example. Nobody would really seriously oppose greater gun controls in the wake of the Christchurch shootings, you know. But they were worried about it. They found a way to be the party that said something different about it, the only one. And they consistently do that, and they'll be doing that on climate action in this election, and waving a flag for all those people who just don't want change in that area. So I think that's a worry, and I think that the bigger question for Luxon is, and for the National Party, is for them to start talking to us about how they're going to manage ACT if they form a government. See that part. The other part of it is, now what Luxon said this week was, we climate change is real. Slapped Maureen Pugh down for suggesting it might not be. Absolutely it's real, absolutely we've got to address it, we've got to spend money on it, we've got to front up to it. But what he was talking about was adapting, not reducing emissions. He never mentions this. what he talked about all week was the adaptation measures that we need to take. So that in effect means better stormwater systems, seawalls, better regulations for where you can build and how you build in floodplains, all of those sorts of areas. Nobody denies those things are important. They're absolutely critical. Now, but there is an argument now that's being developed, which is that we've got to do adaptation instead of lowering emissions. And actually, we need both.
Right on that point, yeah. And I wonder, I think the right in America are very good at speaking on message. You know, it's like the email goes out every morning and then every day the message comes out. This morning, in your lovely paper, the New Zealand Herald, the headline from Matthew Hooton, it's too late to avoid climate change. Now we have to adapt. Do you think that this is a narrative that the right is now going to push through and they're coming together en masse to have the same messaging? Or is it that they're just agreeing with each other? Like, is this a concerted effort and a plan to use that word adapt as opposed to reduce? Or are they just, you know, is Matthew just, I guess, referencing what he's hearing in Luxon, or is there an active narrative behind it being pushed?
So I don't think it's an organized conspiracy, but these people do talk to each other, of course, and I think there is a general consensus among a number of people stretching from Luxon to Hooton. And that's quite a wide range, because Hooton doesn't like Luxon.
It's been clear.
He's not a supporter. He's been clear. In that wide range, there is a pretty common message now to promote the adaptation requirements. It obviously strikes a chord with everyone who can see the need, because it's real. Nobody's denying it. But instead of mitigation, instead of lowering emissions. And Hooton's been arguing against lowering emissions forever. If you go back in time and look at the things he used to write, he's been through the whole gamut of reasons why we shouldn't lower emissions. My personal view is that it's simply the modern contemporary form of denialism. You can't seriously argue that climate change doesn't need addressing, and you can't seriously argue that there isn't a man-made and anthropogenic contributor, a significant contributor to what's happening. The science is settled on all that. But you can, it seems, seriously argue we shouldn't do anything about it. And the argument is adaptation is more important. New Zealand can't make a difference because we're tiny, all those sorts of things. It is just the modern form of the old argument of we shouldn't change our ways.
I think the question will be, like, just from a logistics point of view, can we adapt faster than the climate is changing? Because it's like, you know, you look at places like in the Netherlands that have lots of, that are below sea level and they build walls. It's like the equivalent of, can we build the walls higher and faster than the water levels are rising, or is eventually it going to catch up? But I think it feels a little bit like that argument about crime and stuff, about the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff or the fence at the top of the cliff. So often that argument, people either make one or the other. But what I hear you saying with climate change is we need to make both. We need to figure out how to adapt to what's happening right now with hopefully a reduction to stop it happening in the future.
That's right. You need an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff when someone has an accident, and you also want the fence at the top, of course.
Totally.
I mean, so you're absolutely right. It's got to be both. And the example that I like in all this, when Auckland had its anniversary weekend floods, a lot of us learned about flood paths, which have been built into Auckland's flood resilience systems for some time. They're not good enough yet, but the theory there is that when you have a really wild weather event, when you get an awful lot of rain, you can't build drains big enough to cope with the water. There was a guy from Water Care who told council last week the Wairau Valley, which was very seriously flooded, you could not build a pipe big enough to carry that water away. So what you have to do is recognize that when the drains can't cope, the water's got to go somewhere else and you've got to channel the water. So you make a flood path, which means that if you see the water flowing past your house but not flowing into your house, that might be what it's designed to do. And it might not be a reason to panic. You might want to leave, just in case it doesn't work, but it might not be a reason to panic. And it means that you need parks. It means that all over Auckland, in that terrible storm, there were parks that filled up with water. They became lakes. and then the water drained away again. And that was designed to happen that way.
Yeah.
So if you do that, if you recognize that actually we need parks with open streams, not with closed streams running underground in pipes, but open streams, you are creating a better environment for the normal times with parkland.
Yep.
And you are creating, you are adapting your environment to be more resistant to climate crisis. And those things go together with lowering emissions, because if you have parks in cities, you still got to have people living in cities. So they've got to live perhaps more in apartment blocks, got to live closer together to keep the room for the greenery. So you've got greenery, you've got density, you've got to have them both together. It's terrible when people put up apartment blocks or are allowed to do it and there is no parkland. That is a shocking disgrace. When you have parks, if you're also building apartment blocks, especially around public transport nodes and so on, you've got density and greenery, you're making a better city that will lower emissions, because if it's related to public transport and the ability to ride a bike and walk and get to the shops easily and get to school without having to drive and all those things, you are creating a lower emission society and you are adapting it for the wilder weather. You can do the things together.
We had Officer Collins on after the first round of floods, and he told us, I guess it's what you're describing, that some of the new subdivisions in his area, the houses are built sort of in a circle, and then below the houses is the kids' playground. And then the kids' playground was a lake, but the houses were fine. And we also talked to a specialist about a thing called spongy cities, which is sort of what you're talking about, where basically like exactly as it sounds, the cities, towns need to be able to absorb the water like a sponge and I guess keep dry on the top what it is. It sounds very smart. I don't know, maybe my ignorance is like, you don't learn about these things until these sorts of events happen. And it sounds like a no brainer. And like you say, you know, for those other 360 days of the year that it's not flooded, you've got a lovely park and greenery.
That's right.
How nice is
that's
that?
Right. Yep, that's right. And you know, Auckland is, I read the other day, 35% spongy, which makes it one of the spongiest cities in the world.
Yeah.
Clearly not nearly spongy enough
yet. Yeah.
Which gives you an indication of the scale of the problem we face now. That you know, we don't know what the top end is. If Auckland can have more, 60% more rainfall than they expected in a so-called 1 in 100 year flood, that was entirely unpredicted.
Yeah.
Even by doomsday weather watchers, then if that could happen this year, it can happen again. And we don't know when. And we don't know whether that new record we don't know how long that'll stand. We are living in very dangerous times now.
Yeah. And I was down here in the bottom of the South Island. It's almost like some people down here have got survivor's guilt, because we've had this kind of three weeks of just unbelievable weather, hot, warm, you know, that sort of thing. But I was saying to someone, I get it. And our temperatures dropped off this week to a 9, and we were talking about it. And I was like, not complaining. Just an observation that it's a lot colder today than yesterday, but I'm not complaining about our weather. Trust me, we're not, it's not a complaint. But what I think, unfortunately, not to be a doomsdayer, is with what's happening and more moisture going into the year, it may mean that you'll find that places like Auckland that are subtropical get worse summers, but you might find that places like Dunedin get worse winters, because with that more moisture in the air in the coldest places can lead to more snowfall. So this climate change thing, you might find that, you know, people in the, I'm sure no one in the South Island is gloating, but if there is anybody, I would just hesitate you to wait through the next few winters, because you might find that the colder places and drier places are going to see it in the winter, and the warmer and wetter places are going to see it in the summer, which is a terrifying doomsday prediction. But, you know, that could be the case.
You're absolutely right. It's only 3 years since the whole of the North Island stretching into the South Island was gripped in a terrible drought. You remember just before COVID arrived, we had that awful, awful drought. It's the same thing. We've seen floods in places like Nelson. We've seen wildfire many parts of the South Island. Of course, the West Coast has been terribly hit by flooding. I don't know that you would want to say there's any part of this country that's going to be immune to wild weather. If you haven't had it in the last few years, well, stand by. It's an awful thing to say, but you know.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Hey, the last time we talked, well, maybe it's not the last time, but recently when we talked about this article that you wrote, 2023 election is a choice between the best government yet and the worst. Now, if I can paraphrase it, because that's already a conversation we've had, and if people want to check it out, they can check it out. You were sort of talking about a progressive government under Labor and the Greens because of the Greens' involvement, and a more punitive government under National and ACT because of ACT's involvement. Is that a really fair oversimplification of what the story was about?
No, I think that's right. My view is that from a progressive point of view, the Labor-led governments and we've had in the last 5 years, and they've been different because one of them had New Zealand First playing a particular role. And then it was all Labor, and there was no handbrake, so it was just Labor. We really got to see what Labor was, except that COVID came along and compromised all that. But there are a whole lot of things from a progressive point of view that Labor has not done well or has ignored altogether. In my view, many of those things will be addressed if the Green Party has a strong enough position in cabinet. And I'm talking not just about climate, but also about the environment more generally. And I'm also talking about poverty and about the position of beneficiaries and domestic violence and a whole lot of issues that the Greens have been the champions of. And on the other side of the fence, you've got an ACT party that makes it pretty clear that they want to have a much more conventional, old-fashioned right-wing approach to a whole lot of issues, and are not particularly interested in the national default position, which is, well, we'll sit in the middle and try not to do anything that annoys anybody by just allowing business as usual, if you like.
So I've got two questions around that. The first one is based on when we had that conversation, Jacinda was the Prime Minister. Now Chippy is the Prime Minister. So my first question is, how do we now address this conversation, and does that change anything from when you wrote that article? And my second question, because I'm a terrible interviewer and I'll ask two in a row, is that there's been coalitions before. Why would this coalition, let's say, drag Labor any further to the left and National any further to the right? Because they've been in coalition before. What's the difference this year?
I'll do the second one first.
Yeah.
ACT Party has never been in Parliament, it never been in government and able to influence in the way that they might be able to this time.
So they didn't have enough, weight, you're saying?
Well, if you remember, ACT had some influence with John Key, but John Key had the ability to, with the Māori Party on one side and ACT on the other, he could turn to one or the other to get a majority for anything. If, assuming there's no New Zealand First, and that is a big if, but assuming there isn't, if there's a national ACT government, ACT will be more powerful than it has been in the past. And also, in Seymour, I said before, he's a pretty smart politician. Seymour is extraordinarily smart. Now, he's going to have a very senior role. And because he is good at politics and because he knows what he wants, he's going to run rings around quite a lot of those national people, I think. Now, so there's that. And on the left side, the Greens have not ever been in cabinet without, it's the same issue. When they were in the first Jacinda Ardern government, New Zealand First had more power, more influence.
Right. So what you're saying is, if it's only two parties that make the majority, the both of the minor parties have much more power than they've ever had before to get what they want to get done.
If they have the cabinet responsibility, and that's a thing we haven't seen yet. So, and if they're good enough, they've got to be good at playing it. I think you'd want to say that on the Greens side now they have considerable experience. It's really interesting with the Greens that they have they've been in a situation in support of this government that has killed other minor parties. The Māori Party, most obviously, New Zealand First as well, but it hasn't killed them. They haven't significantly, they've maintained their strength, they've become a lot more experienced. There was last year that flash of disunity when a splinter group tried to get rid of James Shaw.
Yeah.
That rebounded on the splinter group, and the party came out of that extremely strong and united. And I think that was a testament to their organizational credibility, if you like. I've forgotten your first question.
Now, the last time we talked, see, that's why I'm a terrible interviewer. Last time we talked about this article, Jacinda was.
Oh, yes, Jacinda, right. And now Jacinda and Chippy.
Did that change anything to this conversation around the best and the worst government, depending on what people decide in 2023?
I'm not sure that it does. I think Chippy did a very clever thing when he became prime minister. He did a number of things with barbecues and the clothes he wore and so on, which put himself out there as an ordinary bloke. Chippy and Jacinda Ardern have an almost identical political worldview, as far as I can tell, and an almost identical political experience. They both came up through progressive organizations. They both went into parliament as working for MPs and working for ministers, and learned how to do it that way. And they have both been part of the same Jacinda-led government, in a way where Hipkins, you really have to say, was ideologically very closely joined at the hip with Ardern. So I don't see that there'll be a big difference. There's going to be some rhetorical difference. He's going to rolling back some policies, but Jacinda Ardern herself made it clear she was going to do that kind of thing anyway this year. I don't think there'll be a big change.
Other than the baggage, Jacinda's baggage.
So it's all about the perceptions. The perceptions are very different. Absolutely. Yeah, yes.
It also makes me think, when you talk about, you know, these two parties being dragged further to the left and the right, not that you've said it quite like that, but just to paraphrase, based on the minor parties, if you were a progressive voter, like, in other words, you weren't just a left voter, but you are further to the left voter, you probably don't want Te Pāti Māori to be able to get in there then with the left, because if Te Pāti Māori joined up with Labour and the Greens, then you've got the similar situation when Te Pāti Māori joined with ACT and National, that could be a way to stop Labour from going where the Greens want to go if they can rely on the Māori Party as well.
I'm not sure there's a lot of significant difference between Te Pāti Māori today and the Greens on most policies. There are some differences around core Te Pāti Māori issues to do with the role of Māori, but I don't see that the difference is acute in that way.
So they work more hand in hand. More aligned. Obviously, they're more aligned than ACT and the Māori Party, but that's not going to make a big difference.
Absolutely, yeah. If National has to talk to the Māori to Pāti Māori and ACT to form a government, I think that would be an extraordinary thing to be a fly on the wall watching, because on both sides of National there, they've indicated they're not really interested in the other ones. So I don't see that happening.
I was also thinking, and I'd like your perspective on this, David Seymour was on TV last week basically telling people not to trust Arawiri, one of the co-leaders of the Māori Party, and he's not trustworthy and you shouldn't trust him. I kind of felt that if there was ever a glimmer of a chance that the Māori Party could again go with National, that might have killed it. Do you think there's any way, shape or form, you know, like, even if it was the worst of the worst, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, it's better to be in the house than outside the house, any chance that the Māori Party would come into some kind of coalition that included ACT?
I can't see that happening. Having said that, all predictions about the election, I think, are rash. We're still, 7 months away? And we know that sudden events can have an extraordinarily big impact. A change of leader in a party obviously is extremely significant, and it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. You know, we'll have a change of leader somewhere in New Zealand politics. Another big climate event, some kind of economic disastrous event. We don't know what's coming now, but we live in such uncertain times now that I think we can probably rely on something coming to change things. Would Te Pāti Māori and ACT find themselves together because there was some larger issue they wanted to work on? I don't know what that would be. I can't see it, but I wouldn't rule it out.
No predictions around the election, because who knows? But I think the one prediction that I feel, I'd be interested in your thought as well, is it does feel like game on now. The end of last year, it did feel like this is Nationals to lose, whereas since the change of leadership on Labor, it feels like, holy crap, we've actually, this is a competition again now. Does it feel the same to you?
Absolutely. If I had to put money on it, I would assume that unless there are big changes coming along, I would expect that the centre right's going to see a bit of a fall in its support, and centre left probably growing. It's clearly hard to call right now. But the fight is absolutely on. What it will be over, what the big issues will be, I think are somewhat less clear again. The right wants it to be inflation and cost of living. Cost of living will be significant, but will it be the top of mind issue come October? Who knows?
I will ask you this though as well, because it sort of aligns with what you're talking about, the top issues. How do you feel about the National Party at the moment going hard on this Labor is soft on crime, but the reason they're doing it is because of looting, because of a natural disaster? Now, before you answer that, it does kind of, and look, I'm just showing, if you're listening to the audio podcast, you need to go and have a look at what we're doing, but I'm just showing on the National Party Twitter feed at the moment, it's like there's several memes in a row, right? And it's all this whole, there's another one about, you know, where Labor is with crime. There's another one there, new face, same old Labor. I think Christopher Luxon needs to look at his front bench if he's going to be too worried about that. Another one about gangs. And to be honest, it feels real gutter snipe politics. Now, it's politics. You're entitled to do that. But at no stage can I remember Labor coming out with the Christchurch earthquake when there was looting going on, starting to say, look at the looting, National, terrible at crime. I know this is a different, I'm about to use a more extreme example and it's different, but it kind of feels a bit like, oh my God, did you know buildings fell down when John Key was prime minister? National, they're not about building regulations. It kind of feels like that, and it feels real ugly to me. I'm not saying they haven't got the right to put their policy out there, but to use the natural disaster as the launch pad to get into it just feels so gross.
Look, I agree with you. It would be lovely to think that fear wasn't being used as a motivator in the selection campaign, which is clearly well underway, but it is. And I think you're right. It's primarily being used by the opposition, and that's appalling. And even in the situation that they're specifically talking about, it is clear that there have been some criminal activities as a result of that devastation, and that's appalling. But that doesn't mean that Costa was wrong to say that actually domestic violence, family harm, is a bigger issue for us right now. He's got the numbers. There's no reason to believe that he would be wrong about that, because family harm is already the biggest single crime issue in this country. It's the thing that the police get called out to deal with most. More than half their call out. So, it's not a surprise to hear him say that. And really, if you look at the way in which the citizenry have responded to the devastating events of Cyclone Gabriel and the Auckland floods, what you'd have to say is that people have come together and worked together and supported each other and been there with love and practical skills and donations and time and all of those things and community strengths. Now, that should make all of us very proud and looking for ways we can contribute from afar as well.
Yeah.
That's how we've responded to this. We haven't responded by crime. We haven't responded by fear and by terror. Those things, where they've happened, have been isolated, I would say. It's not to downplay the terrible reality of it, but they don't define the way in which New Zealanders have responded to this crisis. Who's surprised at that?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I we're in accord Simon, we're in accord. Still kind of speaking a little bit about the flooding and the response to it as well. I noticed either yesterday or today, Fiso Collins has announced running for the Greens in South Auckland, saying, you know, Labor has taken for granted South Auckland, which is probably fair. How do you think he's going to go for the Greens in South Auckland? Is it going to be two local MPs in Auckland post-election, Chloe and Afiso, somewhere in South Auckland?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? What he's actually announced is that he wants to stand for the Greens for the seat that's currently held by Jenny Salisa. I think that's right. Yep. Go back a few elections, he actually stood against Jenny Salisa for that seat in the Labour Party. She was selected and not him, and as a consequence of that, he became a city councillor instead. Right. So there's some background to that. It isn't yet clear whether the Greens will accept will choose him as their candidate for that seat, and it certainly isn't clear whether they'll play where if anywhere they would place him on their list. My view is that that's an extraordinarily safe seat for Labour, and I wouldn't have thought there was any risk at all of them losing that seat.
I thought he would have swanned into Mount Albert. Like, honestly, I thought that Labour would have been straight on to him and saying, hey, by the way, there's an opening coming up in Mount Albert. How would you like to? But I guess that's not what he's chosen to do, and obviously he's now throwing in with the progressive left as opposed to, I guess, the centre left. And
I think he'd already made it clear by the time Ardern resigned or announced her resignation that he was with the Greens rather than Labour. So that's a part of it. Would Afiso Collins do well in Mount Albert? He would. He tended to do well in that area in the mayoral election anyway. Would he do so well as to win it? Well, it's a safe seat, so yes. But Labour has at least one front-running candidate, Camilla Balich, who is very highly regarded in the party. She's expected to stand for that. So there would have been a big fight over an existing MP who's highly regarded by the party leadership versus Afiso Collins, who the party leadership's never been sure about anyway, would have been very messy.
Other than the five current, which would be Green, Labour, Māori Party, National Act, do you predict any other parties or independents in politics this year? Is New Zealand First going to get back? We're always very careful to say Winston's name because apparently if you say it three times too close together, he turns up in the mirror behind you.
I've heard that.
But first of all, do you see anyone else being in there at post election?
I don't. I wouldn't want to write Winston Peters off. But I do remember the last election. He tired quite badly through the election. 3 years older now. So while he clearly will think that he's got the energy and the ability to come back. I'm not sure about that. It's been pretty obvious that there is no one else in his party, including Shane Jones, who has anything remotely like his appeal. So it's up to him. You don't want to write him off, but I think because this election is going to become so obviously a very tight battle between the centre-left and the centre-right, I think a whole lot of people who might be thinking about Winston Peters at the moment will drift back to one or the other, presumably mainly to the right.
Yeah, and obviously none of those minor parties, the Freedom and Outdoors are nothing. But the thing that I love about those parties as being someone who plants himself firmly on the left is if they can pull away 2, 3, 4% combined from that right vote, then that just helps the left.
I think that's true. And I also think that when those parties find themselves a Winston Peters, they will become a strong force in New Zealand politics. There's no reason to think we're immune from that. It's happened in Britain, it's happened in America. Surely it'll happen here too. They don't have that strong voice yet, which is surprising. They've had several candidates who tried to be that person, but he or she hasn't emerged yet.
Yeah. Hey, as we kind of draw towards a close of the conversation, I wanted to have a quick. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your interview with Jordan Peterson. And the thing that I'm, there's a couple of things for people to know. It's on the New Zealand Herald website. The New Zealand Herald Facebook, YouTube channel has had 50 million views. We're trying to catch up, but you know, at the moment, and this makes up about 3% of the views.
Yeah,
it's there's only 5 videos that are over a million views. This is one of them. It's the only interview that's over a million views. Tell me about your experiences talking to Jordan Peterson.
It was very kind of businesslike, if you like. We did it at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So probably both of us hadn't been up all that long. Certainly hadn't spent the day preparing for it. We did it in the Herald has a studio that was really only just getting started. It was a few years ago now when he visited here. It was oily rag sort of situation. I couldn't hear I had no way of communicating with the producer in the back room, and she didn't have any way of communicating with me, which made it a difficult interview to do on the technical side. Peterson himself came in wearing, he's got a, what's his thing? Turtles, is it, or dragons?
Lobsters. Oh, you said lobsters.
Lobsters, of course. He's got lobsters all over his tie, and it was sort of like, I'm a guy who's got a nice, friendly, you know, informal touch, you know. But I found him difficult.
Prickly, eh?
Very, very, very prickly. And what he does with interviewers like me is that he presents this, I'm a completely sensible person, and I'm just going to out-rationalize you on everything you say, and on it goes. And there's a subtext working through the whole thing, which is a kind of fury. Is a kind of rage that's there, and his followers pick up on that. I still get emails and tweets from people abusing me and wishing me harm because of that interview.
And it's 4 years ago.
Yeah. Absolutely, it's 4 years ago. I've just seen that interview you did, and you know, I hope you rot in hell, or somewhat more graphically described than that. And you think, you know, I always want to say to them, why don't you go and tidy your room before you say things like that? Yeah. Because it's hard to think that Jordan Peterson really would be happy to know that his followers were reacting in that way. Because what he tells you is that he's against that kind of mindset. But actually, he's not.
There is a part in this interview where he goes, well, actually, I've spoken to 350,000 people this year, and not one incidence of aggression, not one incidence. And what you're telling me is certainly virtually, you're still getting signs of aggression 4 years later.
And he knows this. He knows that what people pick up from the way he talks, even when he's doing that, I'm being a super rational man, people pick up from him that it's okay to be absolutely angry, and it's okay to threaten and be violent. Men have had enough, and the war's coming. That's the message they get. And because he knows it, you've got to believe he actually wants that to happen. Because if he doesn't want that to happen, he would change and he would address it.
Wow, that's a terrifying thought. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Well, mate, I was going to say, I am a little bit disappointed. I haven't seen a shirt from you this morning. So you obviously Jordan Peterson more than me. You're just slob about for us.
I know. And... Yeah. wanted to go back to that, what we were talking about at the start with climate change, and why is climate change a left-wing issue?
Yeah.
I was thinking about this morning when I read Matthew Hooton's column, but it strikes me that there's three things you can believe about climate change. You can believe that capitalism will not be able to fix the crisis, because capitalism requires us to use resources more than we can develop in a non-sustainable way. So it's the end of capitalism. Or you can believe that actually that doesn't matter. Capitalism will just go on, and it doesn't matter if we're using up resources. We'll find some technological way to fix it all. Or you can believe that capitalism is the most adaptable economic system we've ever seen in the world, and there's no reason to think that it won't be able to adapt and survive and enable us to survive as well, as long as we behave responsibly rather than just ignoring it. And you can come into it from any one of those you like. You can say the system's broken, the system completely has to change, or you can say actually the system is going to adapt as long as we embrace the problem. Yeah. What you can't say is we'll just ignore it or forget about it.
It's funny we're doing this on a Friday because last night, Thursday night, New Zealand time, we took our evening show off and went and had a bit of a social time. And I played an interview last night with from this podcast, actually. So from the DOC, I played an interview last night on the BHN with a guy called Professor Stephen Lewandowski. And his research is in climate change and conspiracy theories. And he's done some world-leading research, I think in 2012, 2013. And he said that you can find a direct line on free market economics and climate denial. And the rationale is because if you agree that the climate is changing, that you know humans are contributing to climate change, all these sorts of things, then if you agree with it, you have to do something about it. And if you do something about it, it hits your bottom line. And so the reason it's a left, according to his research, and I'll send you the clip, Simon, according to his research, the reason that it's a left-wing issue and not a right-wing issue is because right-wingers are more worried about their money. I'm paraphrasing very badly. And if they acknowledge it and they believe it, then it's going to impact their bottom line. And that's why.
The answer, I'm sure that's true. The answer to it, though, is that Texas at the moment, famous oil-producing state in America, actually has a bigger renewables economy than it does a fossil fuels economy. There are more wind farms and solar farms in Texas than producing more money than in fossil fuels and oil. If you're just about the bottom line, try thinking about the bottom line in 20 years, 30 years, and where you're going to be then.
But see, people don't do that. I mean, if you're in business today, in 20 or 30 years, you want to be retired with your fat settlement. So that's what people in today don't think about. I agree with you. And I think that's the point that you're making, is that there is a shit ton of money to be made in renewable energy right now. So if those free market dudes switch their position slightly, they could keep their free market perspective. And I'm not saying become an Elon Musk, but look at the things in the electric car market and the renewable energy market and all those sorts of things, which, as you say, are actually probably one of the most booming industries at the moment to make money in.
I tell you, I'm reading Eleanor Catton's Burn and Wood, her new book at the moment, which has the whole plot of the story is based around a billionaire like Peter Thiel, who comes to New Zealand and he's illegally extracting rare metals. And it's a eco thriller, if you like. One of the things that's happened in the world in the last 10, 20 years is that people like that have done an extraordinarily good job at persuading us that they have the means to make a better world. And they're not making a better world. They're making a worse world. They're making a better world for themselves and insulating themselves from the consequences. My reading of something like Matthew Hooton's column today with his, it's too late to start mitigating, it's too late to lower emissions, that's simply buying the Peter Thiel line. It's simply buying the argument that there's nothing we can do, so we've got to make a world that's strong enough for us to survive in, and then we'll be okay. We can't do that, and there is no we. There are a few people who will survive. There's certainly no we.
Mad Max. It's just Mad Max, absolutely. All right, last thing, and I wonder, I don't know if you'll give me an answer to this or not, but I talking about the centre-right earlier, sort of losing some of their vote popularity, polling numbers, and the centre-left picking up on it, would you say, therefore, that the tide has slightly turned? So would you put Labour Greens as the slight favourites for this year election, speaking today? Or I guess what I'm asking you for is what's going to happen in the election. What are your thoughts?
Speaking today, I would. Don't ask me what's going to happen on October 14. But speaking today, I would have thought whether you're looking at the response to the climate crisis or whether you're looking at the economy more generally or whether you're looking at who makes up those front benches, whatever it is that's going to spark you, I would have thought that Labour are doing well enough to retain people's interests and therefore perhaps for a lot of them their vote.
and still October 14. You don't reckon Chippy's going to go early? Because I think if Chippy went early now, I mean, because that's what the thing is, isn't it? It's how they're polling now is better. Yeah. And the more time you give someone like Winston, the more viable he becomes. If you went 6 weeks from now, I wonder if they'd have even more of a chance. What are your thoughts?
Well, that was analysis that Hooton pushed a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? I would have thought it's very difficult to call an election right now in the middle of a natural disaster.
True.
I would have thought that takes it right off the table, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, even if they wanted to, they can't, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
Hey, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, Simon. Simon Wilson, a senior writer at the New Zealand Herald. Most of your stuff stays behind the paywall if people want to read it.
Yes, it does. Yes, that they employ me to write premium copy. If people don't want to pay a subscription to the digital subscription to the Herald, it is worth it. There are lots of great things to read in the Herald. But if you don't want to do that, you can buy a newspaper.
Hey, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, Simon. I've loved doing this. I know we've had you before for kind of 10 or 20 minutes here and there, but I really love your writing. I love reading it. I like your perspective. To relaunch the DOC for this year as a more politically focused podcast, I could think of no one better than to have you on board for episode number one. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this a lot.